The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Welcome, my friends, to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show with me, Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide. There's no particular housekeeping or special announcements that I need to make for this particular month, so let's move on with the focus of today's episode. And I'm releasing this episode on the anniversary of a very special, if not tragic, day in the Tudor calendar. A day that, for many people, may argue changed the course of Tudor history and many people's lives forever. Of course, as it is the 2nd of April, I am talking about the sad and early demise of Arthur Tudor, Prince of Wales, born to be heir to the Tudor dynasty. To commemorate this event, I travelled recently to Ludlow Castle in Shropshire, where Arthur was, of course, head of the Council of the Marches. As you will hear in this episode, he had resided there since childhood, but had returned following his marriage to the Spanish princess Catherine of Aragon. And of course, not long after, in fact, after only 4 months, he died there on April the 2nd, 1502. And this changed everything. So in this episode, you will join me as I join our expert guide, Noriko, on site at Ludlow Castle to explore the history of this ancient fortress, as well as to focus in on the story of Arthur at Ludlow and, of course, of his sad and precipitous demise. However, we have a bumper month this month because this is not the only episode I have in mind. Later this month, I'll be dropping part 2 of this series in which I visit Worcester Cathedral to hear all about the funeral of Arthur Tudor and, of course, the magnificent chantry chapel that has been left behind to remember him. That will be coming your way on the anniversary of Arthur's interment at Worcester. So it's a two-parter this month, my friend. I hope you're going to enjoy your time travels with me this month. And so, without tarrying any longer, I think we should time travel to Ludlow Castle and join our guide for this episode. Welcome, dear listeners, to this episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. And as ever, I start by telling you where on earth I am today. Well, I've come about two hours north of where I live, northwest actually, into the county of Shropshire to visit a location which is a real favourite with Tudor history lovers because it has such an important part in Tudor history and saw one of the most tragic events of the period, particularly early Tudor history, really perhaps changed everything. Now, I know many of you listening today will have visited the magnificent Ludlow Castle and its haunted ruined remains, but I've been dying to come back here to record an episode for the podcast, and I'm delighted today to do so. And I am joined by Noriko. Hello, Noriko.
Hello.
So you work at Ludlow. You're going to be our guide today, I understand.
Yes.
So perhaps you could just introduce yourself to everybody. Tell everybody what you do here at the castle and
what your interest, how long have you been interested in Ludlow and its history?
Right. I'm working at the ticket office in a shop, usual sort of customer service things, but I'm also helping deputy manager about the retail side as well. And also I'm making children's trials sometimes. And then I'm interested in this sort of medieval Tudor history since I first came in England, 1996.
Oh, wow. that's quite a while then.
Yes. I also worked at the various places, Hampton Court Palace and blah, blah, blah. So, the Tudor history, medieval history and the ruined castle, that's my most interesting. Yeah,
okay, topic. Right. Yeah, so I know you've got a particular love for this castle. You've
yes.
been doing a lot of personal research.
Yes.
You were telling me before we started recording, your husband's the ex-archivist,
yes.
retired archivist, so you've had access to lots, so I'm sure lots of really interesting information. So thank you for joining us today. So let's just, as I often do, mm-hmm. is just give ourselves a geographic orientation for those people who may not have visited Ludlow, mm-hmm. maybe not be sure of where Shropshire is. Perhaps you could just describe to us where we are in the UK at the moment.
Yeah. The Shropshire is in the border of, they call it Welsh Marches. That means the Welsh border. So that's the Shropshire, Herefordshire, the north part is the Chester. So that sort of area is a Welsh border and the Welsh Marches.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
It's good that we got the definition of the Welsh Marches
yes.
out of the way, because I think people come across that term and wonder initially when they first get into Tudor history, what on earth is or were the Welsh Marches?
Mm-hmm.
But yes. It's a border area. It was
yes.
particularly lawless, wasn't it,
yeah.
back in the day? And so you tend to have some of these great castles, mm-hmm. I guess, that were trying to be the centres of administrating justice and keeping law and order in the area.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that.
No
thank
problem.
You for kicking off there. And I know we're interested in the Tudor history. We're really here because, as I record this, dear listeners, it's mid-March and we are 2 weeks or so away from that very tragic event which I mentioned at the top of the programme, which was the very unexpected death of Prince Arthur here on the 2nd of April. And this, in fact, is the first episode of two where I'll be taking a deep dive into Arthur's story. In today's episode, we're going to be looking at Arthur's time here at Ludlow mm-hmm. and what happened to him. And then actually later on this month, for the anniversary of his internment at Worcester Cathedral, I'm actually going to be recording a second part of this podcast at Worcester, where I'll be talking about his funeral service and the magnificent Chantry Chapel that still exists there today.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a must to visit for
yes.
any Tudor, isn't it?
Yes.
Marika's nodding away. Yes, absolutely. But you can't visit such a wonderful castle as this without just talking about how it got here, what was some of its early medieval history, because mm-hmm. it was here long before the Tudors
yes.
arrived, right?
Yeah. Yeah, originally the Ludlow Castle was built by Norman Baron called Walter de Lacy. Well, he came from Normandy with William the Conqueror. He fought alongside with him. And because of that, he was rewarded a lot of runs around here, Shropshire, Herefordshire. And then he started building castles around the borders. And then original castle actually was what we call Inner Bailey.
Right.
So that the outer bailey now we call.
So we're standing just for people
yes.
who are tuning in. We've started our chat today right in the centre of the outer bailey,
mm-hmm.
which is a large open space
yes.
surrounded by a wall. You can see that there were clearly a number of buildings around the side, and that's very common, isn't it, in a medieval castle?
Yeah.
They were there to service
mm-hmm.
the functioning of the castle.
Yes.
And we're standing looking facing the inner gatehouse
mm-hmm.
and the inner bailey beyond that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pick up the story from there.
Okay. But original castle was within the inner bailey, and then that outer bailey was built around 12th century,
oh,
so a bit later period.
Oh, so it was a much smaller castle
yes.
to begin with. And I mean, this area we're standing in, just for people who are obviously not with us. Oh, by the way, as ever, dear listeners, there will be a show notes page where we'll have some photos so you can be looking at that online if you have the ability to do so while you're listening to us. What's the kind of size of this Outer Bailey? Because it feels quite, it's quite sizable, isn't it?
Yes. It's quite, yeah.
I'm not very good at going, it's XX square feet or metres.
I'm not really good at the numbers, actually. But it is really huge.
Yeah.
You can easily practice the battle or jousting.
And you could joust in here, yes couldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, definitely.
That's actually a really good way of putting it. I think you could easily have a jousting competition in the middle of this Outer Bailey. So that would have considerably, I mean, at least double the size of the castle when it was built.
Yes, yeah. They're much, much bigger than in the Bailey size, I think. So, it's easily, you can put the Inner Bailey into Outer Bailey.
Yeah, yeah. And I, actually, you can't see it from here, but perhaps you can explain why exactly here? Because are we raised up on a plateau of land here?
No, actually, it was like this, and as the bank of the river.
So there's a river down at the foot of the castle.
Yeah. Sometimes you can hear from the top of the tower, the water is running, the river. Yeah. You can see, you can hear the end of the river. That's a River Teme. And because of that, geographically, it's quite perfect. That's on the top of the cliff and then surrounded by the river. So it's quite difficult to attack.
Yeah, it's very defensively. Yes. You've got a natural defence on at least a couple of sides. So that means you only need to defend from the town, which is where the outer gatehouse leads. Okay, so founded shortly after the Norman Conquest, the De Lacy family come along, they build the original castle, which is part of the Inner Bailey.
Yeah. In front of us, there's a big tower, we call Great Tower at the moment. That was the original entrance. You can see, if you visit the castle, the difference between the sort of a blocked archway.
Yes, you can see it clearly, a blocked archway, can't you? Yes.
So that was the original entrance.
I see.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Just architecturally, it makes a lot of sense. So we've got this big, I don't know how many, four, five-storey
tower. It's a little bit lower than the present at the moment. And the later period, that was the build's a little bit higher.
Okay. So the De Lacys were when, roughly? What period are we talking about? Is it the 1100s?
Just after the Norman Conquest.
So literally just after the Norman Conquest. So what happens then? How does the castle get passed through various different families?
Yeah, and mostly the Lacy families occupied, but during the Civil War, Stephen and then Matilda's Civil War.
Yeah, the anarchy.
period. He was exiled, actually, in France.
I see.
And then the castle had the various different occupiers. But during that period, Walter's grandson came back from France, and then he fought back, and then got the castle back.
Oh, he got it back.
Yes.
Okay, right. Right, okay. So from there, because I know what I don't know that much about the early medieval history, but what I do know is that this became a really important castle under a certain Roger Mortimer.
He married the heiress of the castle, who was not the the Lacys, but granddaughter of the last Lacys.
I see, the granddaughter of. Right, I see. So he inherited it through marriage, essentially.
Yes.
I see. I can't remember, what were his dates? I know that he was famously, and we will come on and talk about this, the lover of the Queen of England, Isabella of France, who was married to Edward II. That's 1300 and something, I think.
Yes, the 14th century.
We have come forward then a couple of centuries to the 14th century. And we get to this very interesting period of history. So Roger Mortimer inherits the castle. And what happens then?
Yeah, he was in good term with the king, Edward III that time, and then his son, Prince Edward, future Edward II. But he had the first land in Ireland as well, so he was quite busy in Ireland over there. But that time, later on, Edward II's favourite, Despenser.
Yes.
Yeah. He was sort of trying to get the hold the lands of Welsh Marches.
So, yes, it was an interesting period because the king, Edward II, had a number of, shall we say, close male companions. Yes. One of them, as you mentioned there, was Hugh Despenser.
Yep.
So, okay, so he piles into this area and tries to get the castle back off Roger Mortimer, mm-hmm. which I imagine went down really well. So is that the source of the tension then?
Yes. So he's sort of against Despenser.
Yeah.
And of course, Edward II, he backed him up.
Yeah.
Being Despenser. So in the end, he was prisoned in the Tower of London. But he managed to escape from the tower, which is really unusual.
It's quite something, that.
Yes. Then he went to France to sort of regain his power. And then while he was in France, Edward II's queen, Isabella, came to France as well to negotiate his her brother, King of France. Then that time, maybe they developed the relationship.
So this is between Roger Mortimer and Isabella. So they just both happened to be in France. Mm-hmm. Petitioning for some reason or other, and maybe they developed that relationship, because famously that's what happened,
yes.
isn't it? That they became lovers, and they both, I guess, Isabella wasn't too chuffed that her husband had been running around with male companions or favourites, so they had a natural alliance there. Well, that's interesting, because that's, I mean, I'm sure there are many people listening to this who know well that story, and I know fragments of it, but you've just put a few of the pieces together of that jigsaw puzzle. So we know what happened in that. It didn't end well, did it? For either Hugh or poor King Edward.
No. Well, even Despenser, he was executed in Hereford, about half an hour drive from here, south.
Yeah, and in a very unpleasant manner.
No, really.
Yeah, that's the whole disemboweling thing. So let's not go into that. I hope you're not having your breakfast as you're listening to it. So we'll just skirt over that. And and then, of course, Edward ends up being imprisoned in Berkeley Castle, mm-hmm. Which we've done a podcast at before and visited that area of the castle and the potential cell where he was held. And to cut a long story short there, he dies potentially in an unspeakable manner, although there's a lot of controversy around that. But we don't want to dwell too much on that. What I do want to dwell on, and perhaps this is where we could walk and start walking towards the entrance, the inner gatehouse, is obviously Isabella and Roger emerge from this triumphant.
Yes.
Roger, I assume, now has his castle back.
Yep.
And he develops the castle?
Yes. He built the several private
apartments.
Yes.
So what we're going to do now, dear listeners, is we're actually walking out of the Inner Bailey and we're crossing what's now a dry moat, but I presume at some point there
was... Well, it's been actually dry moat.
It's always been dry, hasn't it? Okay.
Thank you.
what is the current Innergate House, which you can tell architecturally it's a lot later.
Yes. Through the current entrance to the Inner Bailey, on the right-hand side, we have the Judge's Lodgings. That's built by Sir Henry Sidney, which was in Elizabethan time, when he was the president of the Council of the Marches.
I see. So this is an Elizabethan structure, and it's got the windows give it away, the fireplaces, the surrounds all give it away as being Tudor.
Yes.
But we're going to carry on because actually we're skipping through that period and we're entering through an archway into the Inner Bailey, and it's really striking. I mean, we say the castle is in ruins, but there's lots to see here.
Yeah.
So tell me, what are we looking at?
Yeah. In front of us, that's the Great Hall. That's the middle of this North Range complex. The Great Hall is the place you have the entertainment and then banqueting and that sort of stuff. And then on the left-hand side, it's called the Solo Wing. These two buildings were started by Geoffrey de Genneville.
But around what sort of time are we talking about, roughly?
That's about the 13th century.
13th century?
Yes.
Okay, right.
Yeah. But later, when Roger Mortimer took the place, he finished these two places, and then on the right-hand side of the Great Hall, there's a great chamber. He built that great chamber as well.
Right, okay.
With the guardrail tower on behind.
Right, so we've got sort of 13th, 14th century complex, privy
yes.
complex. This is where the innermost lodgings are. You do have the public Great Hall in the centre, but I presume those two blocks, the solar and the Great Chamber block, were used by the Lord
yes.
and his lady and family and mm-hmm. honoured guests. That's where yep. they would dine and so yep. on and so forth.
And then
we're going to sort of come back to roll the story forward, but I can't help but notice this is on my right is a beautiful and quite rare.
It's unusual, unique, very unique.
Tell us about this. I know we're probably going to end our chat inside it, but I can't ignore it because mm-hmm. it's just right there. So can you just talk to us a little bit about this structure, why it's so precious and rare, and what was it?
Yep. This is the round chapel. The name suggests it. So this round chapel was built by one of the Lacys who went to the Crusades and then inspired by the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem.
Okay, so are there any other... I'm trying to think. Are there any? There is at least one other round chapel, but in England, mm-hmm. I think. But I'm trying to struggle to remember where it is. But it is very rare.
Yes. Temple Church in London.
Of course.
Yeah, and then another church in... Is it Cambridge? I think.
I can't remember, but there's going to be people
really
out there who
rare.
Are screaming at the podcast going, it's so-and-so. Anyway, I'm sure folk will let us know. Right, I want to move forward. We're walking towards this rather splendid privy lodging range. It's quite tight in here, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a lot of building in a much smaller space. I mean, mm-hmm. at least half the size of the Outer Bailey. But I do remember reading, Narika, that this was really avant-garde
yes.
for its time.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about why?
It's, Roger Mortimer built this great chamber, and then he also built the guardrobe tower behind it as well.
Right.
That was almost like an ensuite.
I see.
Recent time.
Right. So, I mean, to have kind of interconnected chambers
yes.
with garderobes that were leading off the suites
yes.
at the time that this was built,
yes.
that was, that was five-star luxury.
Yes.
So I also read that after Edward was deposed, this became quite a centre for Roger Mortimer.
Yes.
So assume quite a significance, lots of visitors coming to try and
yes.
gain favour, etc.
Yeah, we don't have official documents and who visited and that sort of stuff, but we believe, I'm sure, they entertained kings which was an Edward III at that time.
Yeah.
And then he did have the his daughter's the wedding party here as well.
Oh, I see, right. So lots of feasting. I love imagining it in its heyday and all the colour and the noise and the smells going on. It's fantastic. Today we've just got the rooks and the crows to keep us company. Okay, so I do now want to move on to the Tudor period because that's predominantly why we're here. But we need to talk about the Council of the Marches and how that came about. When did that first arise as a tradition, or as a... as an administrative body, but then, of course, the reason Prince Arthur came out here was because he was Prince of Wales.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about where that all came from.
Okay. Council of the Marches, maybe first time it was created by Edward I when he created he and his son Edward II as the Prince of Wales. But it was sort of corrupt. A little bit. And then when Edward IV became the king, he revived it. And then he sent his eldest son, Prince Edward, as head of the Council of the Marches.
Yeah. And I think he was with his brother Richard as well. I think they were both... They weren't... But no, well, he wasn't. No. Only Edward.
Yes.
Is that right? Because I have read it's both. So where do we know that it's only Edward? I'm interested in that.
Well, there's no record and Richard's been here.
Is that right?
Yes.
Where is the record that Edward was here? Just out of interest, where does that information come from?
He wrote the observer letters from here as well, as the head of the council as well. So he definitely been here.
Right.
And then we do have this sort of record, someone wrote about it, his timetable of the day.
Yes.
So he raised... about 6 a.m. dawnish, and then have a pray in the chapel and have a breakfast, have a mass, and then have a school. So everything happening here. He was sent from the age of 3.
Ah, right, really, really young. Yeah.
Yes. So almost like his nursery here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was taught how to become king in the future.
And that's really the important point here, isn't it?
Yes.
It's that with Edward IV and then, of course, Henry emulated that with Arthur, this was a place to come and practice.
Yes.
At being king, of having your own household. You were ruling over the... It was a titular head. There were obviously a lot of men who were actually doing the governing, but you were practicing the art of kingship and holding your own household. So that's really interesting about Richard. Well, thank you for exploding that myth. We like to bust the odd myth here and there.
Yeah, because he was with his mother when Prince Edward was held in the Tower, and then Richard III went to Westminster to get his younger son, Richard, from the sanctuary.
Yeah,
so he wasn't been with him all the time anyway, but there's no record.
There's no record of him being here, but we do definitively have a record of the future, the future, very, very brief, King Edward V.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so, Henry comes to the throne, Henry VII, and he's the usurper. Really, he's got, if you talk to people like Nathan Amon, who talks a lot about Henry VII, he would say he's got very little claim to the throne, really. It's very tenuous indeed. So what he has to do is to really establish himself as king by his actions, by what he wears, by the things he does. And so leaning into tradition and following on from what's been done earlier is a natural thing to do. So tell us about... So Arthur becomes obviously Prince of Wales. Mm-hmm. He's born in 1486, if my memory serves me correct. Mm-hmm. When did he arrive here as Prince of Wales in Ludlow for the first time?
Yeah. We don't know exact date, but sometime in 1493.
Right, okay. Yeah. So
he was about seven or eight.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And... I guess he would have followed the same kind of routine that
I believe so.
The previous Prince Edward would have followed. Do we know much about his household and who was with him and who was in the schoolroom with him? What more can you tell us about his time here?
Well, definitely the Jasper Tudor was there. He was the great-uncle to Prince Arthur. And then the local people, Richard Croft from the Croft Castle, yes. He was here.
So he's here from 7 and he's... Sounds like most of the day is either eating mm-hmm. or schooling or praying, essentially.
Yes.
And I suppose, you know, he lived quite a peaceful existence here.
Yeah, he was schooled. Well, it's not just the complicated things, history, language, or sometimes you can practice the fighting, the battles and that sort of stuff as well. And also he played music. There's quite a lot of things.
Is there lots of accounts and documents that survive from his time here?
Yeah, he wrote some letters from here as well as the business matter. But he also wrote a loving letter to Catherine Maligan, future wife.
Did he? Now, let's talk about that because yes. It was while he was here that the mm-hmm. negotiations yes. were underway to get him betrothed to one of the younger daughters of Ferdinand and Isabella. And, of course, that ended up being Catherine of Aragon, of yes. course, as we all know. Can you just fill us in on the timeline in terms of... Because he was, in fact, I think, if I'm right in saying, he was sort of formally married by proxy...
Yes.
..at Tickenhill Manor in Bewdley, which is not a million miles away from here. So all of that was going on mm-hmm. while he was here.
Yes. Yeah.
That's very interesting to think about, isn't it? Can we go and see, where would he have stayed? Where would have his chambers been?
This is really difficult to identify, actually. At the moment, we call top of the ensorted building as a Prince Arthur's chamber.
Yes.
But we are not sure exactly where he actually lodged.
Right, because let's just deduct. We talked about we've got the solar chamber mm-hmm. on the left-hand side of the Great Hall. We've got the Great Chamber block on the right-hand side of the hall. So what we're saying is we think that sort of the highest status privy apartments used by the Lord mm-hmm. of the castle was in the solar chamber, but we can't be 100% sure of that.
Not sure. We do have really elaborate fireplaces.
Should we go in
yes,
and have a look? Because you can go and we're entering. Well, we're walking towards the solar block here. That's what at least was the ground floor, and then two floors above us,
yep.
through an archway, and inside. So it's an empty shell now, isn't it? But you
it
get
is.
A nice idea of
yes.
the size of the spaces, fireplaces, windows, etc. And
on the ground floor level, we have quite huge fireplace, elaborate fireplace. So it could be important chamber, but that's very next to the Great Hall. So I'm not sure you have that chamber just next to the Great Hall. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But you might have like a privy chamber,
yes.
a sort of what we would call almost like a living room,
yes.
directly off the high end of
yeah.
the Great Hall.
And then from the Great Hall, the far end, there's the spiral staircase going up to the top of this,
yes.
The solar block.
Yes.
And then that's, we believe, that might be the Arthur's chamber.
Oh, so there's a sort of, it's not exactly square shaped. It's a sort of a, it, the angles are a bit off, but jutting out from one wall is a sort of square tower. And you can see the stone corbels where the floors would have rested at the two different levels. So you think that potentially at the top level, that might have been the actual bedchamber. But if you, I'm just having a look, you can see it. You can see that the windows on that upper level are the most fine, aren't they? They've got the nicest sort of tracery, or seem to have. So it would be, I can understand. I mean, bedchambers were often on the floor above, above a sort of a privy,
so it
privy
could
chamber.
Be this level or the one level above.
Yeah. So, in that sense, we're probably in the chambers where Arthur lived and died, in fact. Could well be.
Yes.
I get shivers when I think of things like that. Such a sad event. So, before we get to that, though, we should talk about the fact that he gets betrothed to Catherine. He has to go back to London to marry her, because she does eventually arrive, doesn't she?
Yes. Yeah, so he married Catherine in November 1501 at the St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And then they moved to Ludlow Castle in December 1501.
I have to say, I always think of Catherine coming to Ludlow. I love Ludlow. It's a lovely little town.
Yes.
But I have to confess, I've been here about four times now, and every single time I come, it's grey, leaden skies, and or raining, and or freezing cold. And today is, we don't have the rain today, but it's cold and it's grey skies. And I think of poor Catherine arriving, having been used to the beautiful sun of Spain and the Alhambra, the gardens of the Alhambra Palace, and she must have come in just thought, oh my goodness, it's freezing.
It is.
Poor girl.
Yes.
So they were, they basically, we, you know, I'm not doing any spoilers when I say that they were here for about 4 months before tragedy struck. Do we know anything of what happened to them in that time? Are there any records of what went on, or have they been lost completely?
Almost completely gone. But it seems they attended Maundy Thursday, just before he died, and then could be contacted by some sort of illness, because then Catherine herself became ill as well. But she survived, but Arthur didn't.
And the Maundy Thursday, would that have taken place in the town, in the church, or would people have come to the castle? What do you think?
I'm quite not sure where exactly that happened.
Yeah.
But the tradition was the king or prince washing the feet of the apostles.
Yes.
And then might be contacted something that time.
That's interesting. How many days before he became ill was Maundy Thursday that particular year?
So around the time Arthur died was about Easter time.
Yeah.
So it's quite...
Just a few days. We're talking a few days beforehand.
Yes.
That's an interesting hypothesis, isn't it? I'd never thought of that. So there's lots of debate, I think, it's fair to say, about what caused Arthur's death. And I've read, you know, tuberculosis and blah, blah, blah. I'm definitely a proponent that it just seems to have been very sudden to me. So it does seem to have been an infectious.
I personally believe that way, yes. Yeah.
So they both contracted something, and as you quite rightly said, Catherine, both of them were ill.
Yes. Yeah. If both of them had something, it should be something.
And Catherine recovered.
Yes.
So
and then Arthur didn't. So
I mean, to me, it feels like quite an open and shut case of some sort of acute infectious illness that unfortunately took the Prince of Wales very quickly.
Yes.
So tell us about what we know about his death.
He died on 2nd of April at the Ludlow Castle. And then his body was rest maybe in a Great Hall and then maybe the Round Chapel.
So maybe we should just wonder, because we haven't looked in the Great Hall. We're gonna leave this. I'm just thinking, right above our heads, I'm imagining that day, the 1st, the 2nd of April, as his life was slipping away. Must have been such enormous consternation. Of course, his parents were in London and unaware of what was happening. And they wouldn't be told for another couple of days, of course. There was no fast way of getting messages except via, I guess, a horseman riding full pelt to London. So we've come up some stairs. They're the main steps that lead us up into sort of the first floor level, which was the main level of the Great Hall. And it's a beautiful size. We've got. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just describe what we can see here?
Yeah, we have the windows both sides as a sort of defence, the castle. On the north side, the window is much smaller.
Uh-huh.
And then...
Yes, of course.
South side is more open.
Yeah.
So you can have more light from there.
Yeah, it's a good point. That's a really nice little architectural feature just to... It all makes sense. This is what I love about getting to know, to be able to read buildings. You start to be able to make sense of them more.
Yes.
And imagine how they were used more. So I can see on our right-hand side here, we've got a lovely big open fireplace.
Yeah, that was built a bit later period. And they used to have the open the hearth in the middle of the Great Hall.
Yeah, as was traditional in the medieval period. Of course, that began to disappear during the Tudor period. Oh, yes, I can see how the centre arch of what was once a large arch window has been blocked up and the fireplace has been added. Right, so... Arthur's body was brought in here, wasn't it, at some point?
Some point. That's the one document says, yes.
Yeah, so I'm imagining some trestles, the coffin placed upon that. And am I right in saying that the coffin was draped in black?
Yes, yeah.
With a white cross upon it?
I think yes, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I guess, you know, I've written about a number of Tudor deaths and royal deaths, and in fact they still do it today. If you think about the death of Elizabeth II and how she lay in state in Westminster Hall, this is very similar. You've got the coffin upon trestles draped in a flag with late lighted tapers, and no doubt people keeping vigil around the coffin.
Yeah, so his body was guarded by the silver men during the night and the day.
And it was was with Elizabeth II, it still is today.
Yeah,
it's a continuous...
Imagine, that happened almost traditionally in the Tudor time as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so you were saying, because we were having a little bit of chat, obviously, before we started recording, that in fact, we maybe should wander over there to the chapel, it's almost unthinkable that... his body at some point wouldn't have been laid in state in the chapel as well. So when was his... Let's talk about, actually... I know it's... I hope you're not eating your breakfast or your lunch, dear listeners, but can you talk to us a little bit about what happened to a royal body
when
they died?
Yeah, traditionally, medieval time, Tudor time, they take the...
viscera.
In the body.
Bowels.
Organs.
Yes.
Separate to their bodies. And then that happened in the castle. And then the regent said the heart, which means organs, were buried in St. Lawrence's Church in Ludlow.
In Ludlow, right. And in fact, dear listeners, I'm going to be going there shortly. I'm going to take a walk through Ludlow to visit that exact spot, which is commemorated. But for the moment, we've come inside the really beautiful round chapel. Windows all around us. These beautiful, looks like Norman arches around the centre here. How fantastic.
Yeah, you used to have the direct passage the other side, the Great Chamber.
Yes. So you can see a doorway there, which would have sort of connected this chapel, which stands alone in the centre of the Inner Bailey with the main kind of Great Chamber block. So if you're important, you didn't have to go outside if the weather was awful.
Nope.
You could. So there must have been some kind of pew area.
Yes.
For the high status people to look down.
Yeah, usually kings and queens and princes, they have the own pew above everyone else.
Yeah. So you can imagine, I mean, Arthur and Catherine would have sat up there, right?
Yes.
For sure. That's great. I love it. and this huge Norman archway at one end. Was that open, or was that doors? Was that where the main door?
No, that's the actual nave was there. So that's the
Oh, I see. Yeah. Now that makes sense. So what we're seeing here, there's a board in front of us, dear listeners. And in fact, we'll take a photo of it. Can maybe take a photo of that? We'll just illustrate it beautifully for people. There were two parts to this chapel. Mm-hmm. There was the round part, mm-hmm. and then there was, leading from it, there was a square nave which ran up to the wall of the inner bailey. And that looks like where the pews were.
Yes.
And that's how... I see. Yeah. I see. Then the royal pew looks down onto that square choir bit or nave. Was it nave or choir?
Choir, maybe.
Choir, yeah, it's choir, because I guess here we've got the high altar at the end.
So the altar is that end by the wall.
So this is almost like a vestibule.
Yes.
But the main service goes on in the... it all makes sense now. That's wonderful. Okay, well, I'll step back to let Chris take a picture of that for you folks. That makes a lot of sense. So, in which case, Arthur's body may well have lain up there in
the
choir area that's directly in front of us, in front of the high altar. Mm-hmm. What a sad time. What a sad time. Mm. Well, I think we're probably coming to the end of our chat. Mm. I would just like to mention, of course, Arthur wasn't the only Tudor royal to live here, because Princess Mary came in the same capacity.
Yes. So then Henry VIII followed the custom, and he sent the future Mary I as a princess of the Wales, as a sort of head of the council marches again. But she spends not a lot of time, maybe about 3 winters.
Okay, so not as long as Arthur. Yeah. But nevertheless here, maybe, I always think it's quite poignant. She must have been thinking of her mother, who spent time here, and all the tragedy that happened with her uncle.
Yeah. I'm more sort of worried about, Catherine might thought about, her sad days in Ladlow.
Yeah.
And losing her first husband and then sending her daughter to the exact spot.
That's true. Mm. She must have been really worried.
Yes.
Yeah, but didn't have any say in the matter. Mm. Okay, well, that does bring us, I think, to the end of our chat. But before we say goodbye, perhaps you could let people know how they find out more information online about visiting. When can people visit? Are you open all year? Do you have any special events that you'd like to let people know about that are coming up this year?
The Ladlow Castle is open 7 days, apart from the end, so January and then half of the February, which is just open weekends.
I see.
But we open literally 7 days a week. But we do have a lot of events, especially we're having Meet the Tudors in May, end of May.
Which Tudors are you having? Are you focusing on the early Tudors, the later Tudors?
We are not sure much detail at the moment, but the last year we had Prince Arthur.
Okay, lovely.
And then Harry VIII as well, and then his 6 wives.
Okay, great. All of them here, happy families. okay, and any other events? Because you do have lots of events, don't you, here at Ludlow? I mean, Ludlow's known for its food festival, so if you love food and castles, this is a great place to go.
So we have the Spring Festival in May as well. That's the early May. And then we do have the Adventure Cinema in June.
What's the Adventure Cinema?
Have the sort of outdoor...
The outdoor cinema.
Yes.
Yeah, lovely. Because you've got the space for it here in the Outer Bailey. That'd be quite something.
And then in July, we have the live concert. So 2 weekends.
And is that every year? Is this something that you tend to repeat every year? So if people can't make it this year, they may be able to come on in the future.
This is the third year, actually. It started just the 3 days, the last year and the previous year. But this year we have, at the moment, 7 performances been scheduled. That's the sort of end of, the middle of July and then towards end of July.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And then September, we have Food Festival.
Yeah, and as I said, that's all going on in the town as well as here. I mean, the whole place is buzzing, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have the big tent in the outer bailey and all the food benches there.
Yum, yum, yum.
Okay, so... So basically, as ever, it's checking out the website for all the latest information.
Yes.
But essentially, you're open almost all of the year, except January and part of February, where it's weekends only.
Yeah. But the big events like the concerts and then the food festival, we have to close for the setting up. And then
Makes sense.
Check the other websites for the end of autumn times, please.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, lovely. Well, thank you so much. We haven't managed completely to freeze. It's not been to... I've done worse. But thank you so much
thank
for being our guide.
Thank you very much for having me.
Friends, well, I hope you enjoyed that tour of the castle, and actually you've just headed out from the main gatehouse, which opens up into the centre of Ludlow, into its marketplace, as undoubtedly it did many years ago. And we are literally now, or I am literally, and you virtually, I'm walking in the footsteps of the funeral procession of Arthur, because there was only one way in and out of the castle, and this was the way that led directly to St Lawrence's Church. Pardon me. St Lawrence's, of course, was the main parish church in Ludlow. Now, we are out and about in the town, so you will be hearing the sounds of everyday life going on around us today, as we hopefully take a little walk to the parish church and to stand and remember Arthur as his body was conveyed onwards towards Worcester, and also see the plaque in the floor of the parish church there, which commemorates the fact that Arthur's heart, viscera, were buried in the church. Now, Noriko was talking, of course, about this as being a tradition. Once a royal body died, very soon after death, the usual practice would be to remove the bowels and the heart. Sometimes the heart was buried in one place, the bowels somewhere else. But it was an essential thing to do, because obviously after death, certain things, let's not go into too much detail, my friends. So it was an important thing to do after death, because of course the body began to decompose, and as we know with a certain Henry VIII, and indeed with Elizabeth I, although that's much less talked about, the body can explode. So it was a normal practice to do that. The body would then be seared or embalmed, often placed in a leaden coffin, and as we know in the case of Arthur, that coffin was put on public display, certainly by the 23rd of April, which was the day that Arthur's body was due to be removed from the castle for its onward journey towards his final resting place. It was there in the Great Hall. Now, we are walking through tiny little streets, back streets of Ludlow. It's a very little cute town. And if you visit, you will find that there are some beautiful timber frame buildings, which are clearly medieval and Tudor in origin. It's lovely to linger a while. It's a lovely historic market town. And right the way down one of these back alleys, I can see the sign to the parish church. The parish church of St Lawrence, which is open. Now, I'm hoping to be able to record briefly in there, but of course we don't want to disturb people too much. So anyway, here we are. And it's an interesting church because it's tucked back off the main street, and suddenly you come upon it with its porch and then its quite magnificent tower. So before we go inside, let me just talk to you a little bit about what we know of the funeral procession. We do know that the chief mourner on that day was Thomas Howard, the Earl of Surrey. Now, of course, Thomas Howard became later Thomas Howard the Third, Duke of Norfolk. By this stage, it's clear that his reputation had been reasonably well rehabilitated after fighting on Richard III's side at the Battle of Bosworth. Following Surrey were the Earls of Shrewsbury and Kent, and as with the other mourners, they were all dressed in black jackets and hoods. And I think overall there were about, I think I've read there were about 200 mourners in total. And of course, the reason why we have a gap between the 2nd of April, when Arthur dies, and the 23rd of April, when his body begins its procession towards Worcester, is that it was an unexpected royal death. And there were all sorts of preparations that needed to happen. The accoutrements of any royal funeral needed to be assembled. Garments needed to be made, fabric needed to be sourced. Huge amounts of wax, I believe, were purchased from Worcester for the lighted tapers that would burn around the four edges of Arthur's coffin night and day between his death and his burial. So anyway, 3 weeks pass, and here we are on the 23rd of April. We have the procession headed by Thomas Howard. We have also Lords Grey of Ruthin, Dudley, Grey of Powis, and Sir Richard Pole, who was Arthur's chamberlain. The sons of other lords were also present. Some of them were Arthur's friends, such as Anthony Willoughby, Edward Howard, and Robert Radcliffe. And in fact, they were the ones that held the poles, steadying a canopy of purple damask, which was carried over Arthur's coffin. Behind all of that, there was a trail of 80 poor mourners, each of them carrying a burning taper. And now that procession eventually, sadly, wound its way the short distance from Ludlow Castle here to St. Lawrence. And the coffin was then taken inside to be laid in the choir, where a funeral mass was led by the Bishop of Lincoln, a man called William Smith. Now, Arthur remained here in the church for at least a couple of days. We know that a vigil was kept over the corpse all that first night after a mass was said. And then the following day, masses and doles were repeated. And a prominent role, we know, was given to the Spanish ambassador, Pedro de Alia, and some of the other town officers of Ludlow. So, of course, for the second part of this podcast, we will be following Arthur on his onward journey. But for now, let's conclude by going inside the church and seeing the memorial to Arthur and where his body lay in state for the final time before he left Ludlow.
So we've had a quick chat with the church warden, who has kindly given us permission to record here inside the church. As you can hear, there's a lovely hubbub going on at the church cafe. It's very popular. You see that more and more in churches these days over here in England. It brings more life into the church. It's lovely and warm in here, which is great. Now, it's a beautiful parish church, actually, very lofty. It's bigger than your average church. And I'm making my way up one of the side aisles to see if I can get into the choir. And here we are, passing underneath a beautiful carved wooden screen. I'm not entirely sure the age of that screen, but it wouldn't surprise me if it has a few centuries under its belt. Now, we are very lucky, my friends, because we are alone here. This is the choir of St. Lawrence's Church, and it definitely has a sense of the late Perpendicular type of architecture with what looks to be a ceiling from sort of the late, I would say the late 1500s, early 1600s. The great east window is in front of me, and I'm making my way up the choir towards the high altar. And the thing that catches your attention is that they have put out a little notice board about Prince Arthur. And next to it, on the floor, is a plaque which reads, Arthur, Prince of Wales, died at Ludlow Castle, 2nd of April 1502, aged 15 years and 7 months. His heart was buried near this place. Also, probably his bowels, it has to be said, but it's nicer, isn't it, to write just the heart. And so this is where, right where I'm standing, I think, I'm imagining right in the centre of the upper part of the choir, right before the high altar, we can imagine Arthur's coffin on a trestle, draped in black cloth with its white cross. At each corner, lighted tapers, and various individuals, probably of his household, and the townsfolk, prominent townsfolk, perhaps holding vigil night and day as Mass was sung and prayers were said for the soul of the departed Prince of Wales. Now, as I said just a little while ago, in the next episode, we'll be making our pilgrimage to Worcester Cathedral, where Arthur would be buried in a grand ceremony. And we'll also be visiting his fabulous Chantry Chapel, which really absolutely is a must-see for any lover of Tudor history. It's a very poignant place to stand and ponder, what if Arthur had lived? Well, before we leave the church, of course, just a reminder that if you are visiting Ludlow and you visit the castle, do come across to St. Lawrence's. It's literally just a few minutes walk away across the marketplace. And the church warden has reminded me that it's open every day except Boxing Day from 10 till 5pm. And of course, it's free to get in. So hopefully you will be able to make that journey. Right, my friends, well, join me again later this month for that second episode, where we can conclude our story of the life and the very sad and tragic death of Prince Arthur.
Well, it's always a pleasure to visit the pretty little town of Ludlow. And dare I say, towards the end of our visit there, the sun actually came out and shone upon the castle. And I managed to get across the other side of the river to get some lovely shots of the castle, which I hope to share with you on my Instagram. But I just wanted to say a massive thanks to Noriko for being our guide today, and for Julia, who organised this visit to the castle. It was fantastic to finally tell Arthur's story there. I hope you enjoyed the visit as much as I did. And remember, coming your way later this month will be the second part of this particular series, in which I hear all about the final funeral and interment of Arthur and the fabulous Chantry Chapel, which still exists today and can be visited at Worcester Cathedral. you can expect to see that drop into your feed on the 25th of April, which will be 523 years to the day since Arthur was finally laid to rest. So keep your eyes peeled, that will be coming your way shortly. All right, my friends, that's all from me for this episode. I'll see you in part two. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!